by David Eddings, continuing on page 144. Olaf nodded and walked up the street to a tavern and went inside, where he joined Tinian at a table near the fire.
"What did you do with our shaggy friend?" he asked.
"He went out looking for another dog," Tinian replied. "You might have made a mistake there, Sergeant. He seems to be developing a taste for them. There won't be a dog left in the whole town if we stay much longer." Olaf sat down and leaned back.
"Ran into an Aline fellow out there in the street," he said,
loudly enough to be heard by the other tavern patrons. "Oh," Tinian said casually, "Estellian or Edomish?"
"It was sort of hard to say. He'd had his nose broken at one time or another, so it was a little hard to determine his race. He was looking for a good inn, so I recommended the one where we're staying. We might see him there. It's good to hear somebody talking Alenic for a change. I get tired of listening to people babbling at me in Tamil. If you're about finished here, why don't we drift on down to the harbor and see if we can find somebody to ferry us on across the lake to Tiana?"
Tinian drained his tankard. "Let's go," he said, standing up. The two of them left the tavern and strolled back to their inn, talking casually and moving at the leisurely pace of men with nothing really pressing to do.
"I want to have a look at that shoe on my horse's left forehoof," Olaf said when they arrived. "Go on ahead. I'll meet you in the tap room."
"Where else?" Tinian laughed. Khalad was in the stable, as Olaf had expected. He was making some show of currying Farron.
"I see that you and your friend decided to stay here," the big Salesian said in a casual tone.
"It was handy."
Khalad shrugged.
"Listen carefully," Olaf said, in a voice hardly more than a whisper. "We were able to pick up some information. Nothing's going to happen here. You'll get another one of those messages."
Khalad nodded.
"It's going to tell you to go on across the lake to Tiana. Be careful of what you say on the boat, because there'll be a fellow on board who's working for the other side, an Arjunai with a long scar on his cheek."
"I'll keep an eye out for him," Khalad said.
"You'll get another message in Tiana," Olaf continued. "You'll be told to go on around the lake to Arjun."
"That's the long way around," Khalad objected. "We could take the road from here and be in Arjun in less than half the time."
"Evidently, they don't want you to get there that soon. They've probably got some other irons in the fire. I won't swear to this, but I think they'll send you on to Doral from Arjun. If Calton's right and Elana's being held in the Tayos, that would be the next logical step."
Khalad nodded again.
"I'll tell Barrett. I think we'd better stay out of that tap room. I'm sure we're being watched, and if we start talking with other Alines, we'll just put the other side on their guard."
The horses in the stable suddenly began to squeal and kick at the sides of their stalls.
"What's wrong with the horses?"
Khalad demanded.
"And what's that odd smell?"
Olaf muttered an oath. Then he raised his voice and spoke in Trollish.
"Blockus, it is not good that you come into the dens of the man-things this way. You have been eating dog, and the man-things and their beasts can smell you."
There was an injured silence as Olaf's unseen traveling companion withdrew from the stable. Petwana and Engessa, dressed in sleek otter skins, accompanied Vanyan and the knights south from Sarna. At Engessa's suggestion, they proceeded due west to come down out of the mountains in eastern Seneska.
"We've been watching them, Vanyan Preceptor," the towering Aton said as he loped along beside Vanyan's horse. "Their main supply dump is about 5 leagues west of the frontier."
"Did you have anything pressing to attend to, Your Majesty?"
Vanyan asked Betwana, who was running along on the other side.
"Nothing that can't wait. What did you have in mind?"
"Since we're here anyway, we might as well swing over and burn their supply dump. My knights are getting restless, and a little exercise might do them some good."
"It is rather chilly," she observed with just a hint of a smile. "A fire would be nice."
"Shall we, then?"
"Why don't we?"
The Seneskan supply dump covered about 5 acres. It lay in a rocky, treeless basin, and it was defended by a regiment of Seneskan troops in flowing robes. As the column of armored knights approached, the defenders galloped forth to meet them. That particular maneuver might best be described as a tactical blunder. The gravel-covered floor of the desert of Seneska was flat and clear of obstructions, so the charge of the church knights was unimpeded. There was an enormous crash as the two forces collided, and the knights, after only a momentary hesitation, rode on, trampling the bodies of the wounded and slain under the steel-shod hooves of their mounts, while the squealing horses of the Seneskans fled in terror.
"Impressive," Petwana conceded as she ran along beside Vanyan's mount. "But isn't it tedious to endure the weight and the smell of the armor for months on end for the sake of 2 minutes of entertainment?"
"There are drawbacks to any style of warfare, Your Majesty," Vanyan said, raising his visor. "A part of the idea behind armored charges is to persuade others to avoid confrontation. It holds down the casualties in the long run."
"A reputation for extreme severity is a good weapon, Vanyan Preceptor," she agreed.
"We like it." He smiled. "Let's go build that bonfire so that Your Majesty can warm her toes."
"That would be nice." She smiled.
There was a dust-covered hill directly ahead, rising like a slightly rounded pyramid to block the way to the supply dump. With simple arm gestures, Vanyan directed his knights to diverge and sweep around both sides of the hill to swarm over the accumulated supplies of Sirdan's army. They galloped forward with that vast, steely, clinking thunder that proclaims implacable invincibility. And then the hill moved. The dust which had covered it shuddered away in a great billowing cloud, and the two enormous wings unfurled their glossy blackness to reveal the wedge-shaped face of Clell. The beast of ultimate darkness roared, and the fangs of lightning, jagged and flickering, emerged from behind snarling lips. And out from beneath the shelter of those two great wings came an army like no army Vanyan had ever seen. They were as tall as the Aetons, and more bulky. Their bare arms were huge, and their steel breastplates fit them like a second skin, revealing every knotted muscle. Their helmets bore exotic-looking embellishments, horns or antlers or stiff steel wings, and, like their breastplates, their visors fit tightly over their faces, exactly duplicating the features of each individual warrior. There was no humanity in those polished faces. The brows were impossibly wide, and, like the face of Clell himself, they narrowed down to almost delicately pointed chins. The eye slits blazed, and there were twin holes in place of noses. The mouths of those masks were open, and they were filled with cruelly pointed teeth. They swarmed out from beneath Clell's wings, with his lightning playing around them. They brandished weapons that appeared to be part mace and part axe, steel atrocities dredged from a nightmare. They were too close to permit any kind of orderly withdrawal, and the knights, still moving at a thunderous gallop, were committed before they could fully comprehend the nature of the enemy. The impact as the two armies came together shook the earth, and that solid, steely crash shattered into a chaos of sound. Blows, shrieks, the agonized squeals of horses, and the tearing of metal.
"Sound a withdrawal!"
Vanyan bellowed to the leader of the Genidians.
"Blow your heart into that ogre horn, man! Get our people clear!"
The carnage was ghastly. Horses and men were being ripped to pieces by Clell's inhuman army. Vanyan drove his spurs home, and his horse leapt forward. The Pandian preceptor drove his lance through the steel breastplate of one of the aliens, and saw blood, at least he thought it might be blood, thick, yellow blood, gushing from the steel-lipped mask. The creature fell back, but still swung its cruel weapon. Vanyan pulled his hand clear of the butt of the lance, leaving the beast transfixed, skewered as it were, and drew his sword. It took a long time. The thing absorbed blows that would have dismembered a human. Eventually, however, Vanyan chopped it down, almost like a peasant chopping at a tough, stringy thorn bush.
"Endesa!"
Petwana's shriek of rage and despair rang out above the other sounds of the battle. Vanyan wheeled his horse and saw the Aeton queen rushing to the aid of her stricken general. even the monstrous creatures Clell had unleashed quailed in the face of her fury as she cut her way to Angessa's side. Vanyan smashed his way through to her, his sword flickering in the chill light, spraying yellow blood in gushing fountains.
"Can you carry him?"
he shouted to Betuana. She bent, and with no apparent effort, lifted her fallen friend in her arms.
"Pull back!"
Vanyan shouted.
"I'll cover you!"
And he hurled his horse into the path of the monsters who were rushing to attack her. There was no hope in Betuana's face as she ran toward the rear, cradling Angessa's limp body in her arms, and her eyes were streaming tears. Vanyan ground his teeth together, raised his sword, and charged. Sophrenia was very tired when they reached Dirges. "I'm not really hungry," she told Zanisha and Afriel, after they had taken a room in a respectable inn near the center of the city. "All I want is a nice hot bath and about 12 hours of sleep."
"Art thou unwell, sister mine?"
Zanisha's voice was concerned. Sophrenia smiled wearily.
"No, dear,"
she said, laying one hand on the Anaray's arm.
"Just a little tired. All this rushing around is starting to wear on me. You two go ahead and have some supper. Just ask someone to bring a small pot of tea up to the room. That'll be enough for right now. I'll make up for it at breakfast time. Just don't make too much noise when you come up to bed."
She spent a pleasant half hour immersed to her ears in steaming water in the bathhouse, and returned to their room tightly wrapped in her styric robe and carrying a candle to light her way. Their room was not large, but it was warm and cozy, heated by one of the porcelain stoves common in Tomalee. Sophrenia rather liked the concept of a stove, since it kept the ashes and cinders off the floor. She drew a chair close to the fire and began to brush her long black hair. Vanity, Sophrenia, after all these years? She started half to her feet at the sound of the familiar voice. Zelasta scarcely looked the same. He no longer wore his styric robe, but rather a leather jerkin of an Arjunai cut, stout canvas trousers, and thick-soled boots. He had even so far discarded his heritage that he wore a short sword at his waist. His white hair and beard were tangled, and his face was haggard. "Please don't make a scene, love," he told her. His voice was weary, and devoid of any emotion beyond a kind of profound regret. He sighed. "Where did we go wrong, Sophrenia?" he asked sadly. "What tore us apart and brought us to this sorry state?"
"You don't really want me to tell you, do you, Zelasta?" she replied. "Why couldn't you just let it go? I did love you. Not that way, of course, but it was love. Couldn't you accept that and forget about the other?"
"Evidently not. It didn't even occur to me."
"Sparhawk's going to kill you, you know."
"Perhaps. To be honest with you, though, I no longer really care."
"What's the point of this, then? Why have you come here?"
"I wanted to see you one last time, hear the sound of your voice." He rose from the chair in the corner where he had been sitting. "It all could have been so different, if it hadn't been for Afriel. She was the one who took you into the lands of the Alenes and corrupted you. Your Styrix, Sophrenia. We Styrix have no business consorting with the Alene barbarians."
"You're wrong, Zelasta. Annika's an Alene. That's our business with them. You'd better leave. Afriel's downstairs eating supper right now. If she finds you here, she'll have your heart for dessert."
"In a moment. There's something I have to do first. After that, she can do anything to me she wants to." His face suddenly twisted into an expression of anguish. "Why, Sophrenia, why? How could you bear the unclean touch of that Alene savage?"
"Vanyan, you wouldn't understand. You couldn't even begin to comprehend it."
She stood, her face defiant.
"Do whatever it is you have to do, and leave. The very sight of you sickens me."
"Very well." His face was suddenly as cold as stone. She was not really surprised when he drew a long bronze dagger out from under his jerkin. In spite of everything, he was still styric enough to loathe the touch of steel. "You have no idea of how much I regret this."
he told her as he came closer. She tried to struggle, clawing at his face and eyes as she called out for help. She even felt a momentary sense of triumph when she seized his beard and saw him wince with pain. She jerked at his beard, sawing his face this way and that. But then he jerked free, roughly shoving her back from him. She stumbled back and half fell over a chair, and that was what ultimately defeated her. Even as she struggled to regain her feet, he caught her by the hair, and she knew that she was lost. Despairing, she drew Vanyan's face from her memory, filling her eyes and heart with his features, even as she attempted again to claw at Zelasta's eyes. And then he drove the dagger directly into her breast and wrenched it free again. She cried out, falling back and clutching at the wound, feeling the blood spurting out between her fingers. He caught her in his arms. "I love you, Sophronia," he said in a broken voice, as the light faded from her eyes. Part 2. Natalios. Chapter 11. "I can't find anybody willing to stay in one place long enough for me to ask him any questions," Comier growled when he returned late one cloudy afternoon with his scouts. He looked sourly back across the empty, winter-fallow fields, all neatly bordered with low stone walls, carefully shifting his broken right arm. "These Astellian serfs all take one look at us and bolt for the woods like frightened deer." "What's ahead?" Darylin asked him. Darylin's helmet hung from his saddle bow, one side so crushed in that it no longer fit his bandaged head. His eyes were unfocused, and his bandage was blood-soaked. Comier took out his map and studied it. "We're coming to the River Astell," he replied. "We saw a city over on the other side. Darsus, most likely. I couldn't catch anybody to tell me for sure, though. I'm not the prettiest fellow in the world, but I've never had people flee from me in terror like this before."
"And then warned us about that," Bergston said. "The countryside's crawling with agitators. They're telling the serfs that we've all got horns and tails, and that we're coming here to burn down their churches and ram assorted heresies down their throats at sword point. This fellow called Saber seems to be the one behind it all."
"He's the one I want," Comier muttered darkly. "I think I'll run him down and set him up as the centerpiece in a bonfire."
"Let's not stir up the locals any more than they already are, Comier," Darylin cautioned. "We're not in any condition for confrontations at the moment." He glanced back at the battered column and the long string of wagons bearing the gravely wounded.
"Did you see any signs of organized resistance?" Heldon asked Comier.
"Not yet. I expect we'll find out how things really stand when we get to Darsus. If the bridge across the Astell's been torn down and the tops of the city walls are lined with archers, we'll know that Saber's message of peace and goodwill's reached the people in authority." The Genidian preceptor's face darkened, and he squared his shoulders. "That's all right. I've fought my way into towns before, so it won't be a new experience."
"You've already managed to get Abriel and about a third of the church knights killed, Comier," Bergston told him pointedly. "I'd say that your place in history's secure. Let's try a bit of negotiation before we start battering down gates and burning houses."
"You've had a clever mouth ever since we were novices, Bergston. I should have done something about that before you put on that cassock."
Bergston hefted his war axe a couple of times.
"I can take my cassock off any time it suits you, old friend," he offered.
"You're getting sidetracked, gentlemen," Darylin said, his speech slightly slurred. "Our wounded need attention. This isn't the time to pick fights, either with the local population or with each other. I think the four of us should ride on ahead under a flag of truce and find out which way the wind's blowing before we start building siege engines."
"Am I hearing the voice of reason here?" Heldon rumbled mildly.
They tied a gleaming white serenic cape to Sir Heldon's lance and rode ahead through the cheerless afternoon to the west bank of the River Astell. The city beyond the river was clearly Aline, an ancient town with soaring towers and spires. It stood proudly and solidly on the far shore of the river under its snapping pennons of red and blue and gold, proclaiming, or so it seemed, that it had always been there, and always would be. It had high, thick walls, and massive closed gates.
The bridge across the Astell was blocked by towering, bronze-faced warriors wearing minimal armor and carrying very unpleasant-looking weapons.
Aetons, Sir Heldon identified them. We definitely don't want to fight those people.
The ranks of bleak-faced infantry parted, and an ancient, wrinkled Tamil in a gold-colored mantle came forward to meet them, flanked by a vastly bearded Astellian clergyman, all in black.
Well met, Sir Knight.
The hairless old Tamil greeted the armored men in a dry, dusty voice.
King Alberon's a trifle curious as to your intentions. We don't see church knights in this part of the world very often.
You would be Ambassador Fontan, Bergston said. M'Ban described you very well.
I thought he had better manners,
Fontan murmured. Bergston flashed him a brief smile.
You might want to send word back to the city, Your Excellency. Assure His Majesty that our intentions are entirely peaceful.
I'm sure he'll be happy to hear that.
M'Ban and Sir Tinian came back to Kyrellos a couple of months ago, Bergston continued. Sparhawk sent word that things were getting out of hand here. Dolmont dispatched us to help restore order.
The huge patriarch made a sour face.
We didn't get off to a very good start, I'm afraid. We had an unfortunate encounter near Bosna, and we have many wounded in need of medical attention.
I'll send word to the nearby monastery, Sir Knight, the bearded clergyman standing at Fontan's elbow offered.
Bergston's not a knight anymore, Your Reverence, Tomier corrected him. He used to be, but God had other plans for him. He's a patriarch of the church now. He prays well enough, I suppose, but we haven't been able to get his axe away from him yet.
My manners must be slipping,
Fontan apologized.
My friend here is Archimandrite Monsel, the duly anointed head of the Church of Astell.
Your Grace,
Bergston inclined his head politely.
Your Grace,
Monsel replied, looking curiously at the warlike clergyman. Your friend M'Ban and I had some very stimulating discussions about our doctrinal differences. You and I might want to continue those, but let's see to your wounded first. How many injured men do you have?
Roughly 20,000, Your Grace,
Comier answered bleakly. It's a little hard to keep an exact count. A few score die on us every hour or so. What in God's name did you encounter up in those mountains? Monsel gasped.
The King of Hell,
as closely as we can determine, Your Grace, Carolyn replied. We left 30,000 dead on the field, mostly Cyrenics. Lord Abriel, their preceptor, led the charge, and his knights followed close behind him. They were fully engaged before they realized what they were up against. He sighed. Abriel was nearing 70, and he seemed to think he was leading his last charge.
He was right about that, Comier grunted sourly. There wasn't enough of him left to bury.
He died well, though, Heldon added.
Do you have any fast messengers available, Your Excellency? Sparhawk and Vanyan are counting on us to reach Mithyrian as soon as possible, so we'd probably better let them know that we're going to be delayed.
His name's Valish,
Stragan told Sparhawk and Talon, as the three of them, still wearing their tar-smeared sailor smocks, stepped out of the noisy, torchlit street into a dark, foul-smelling alley.
He and his two friends are Dacites from Varel.
Have you been able to find out who they're working for?
Sparhawk asked him, as they stopped to let their eyes adjust to the darkness and their noses to the smell. The alleys of Varessa were particularly unpleasant.
I heard one of them mention Ogorajan, Stragan replied. It makes sense, I guess. Ogorajan and Velasta seem to be old friends.
I thought Ogorajan's brains were rotting out, Talon objected.
Maybe he has lucid moments. It doesn't really matter who sent them, though. While they're here, they're reporting to Krager. As near as I can make out, they've been sent to assess the damage we did to them during the Harvest Festival and to pick up any bits of information that fall to hand. They've got money, but they don't want to turn much of it loose. They're in this strictly for gain. And for the chance to seem important.
Does Krager come here to get their reports?
Sparhawk asked.
He hasn't recently. Valish communicates with him by messenger. These three Dacites are seriously out of their depth here. They want to hold on to as much of the money Ogorajan gave them as they can, but they don't want to miss anything important. They aren't professionals by any stretch of the imagination. They spend most of their time trying to figure out some way to get information without paying for it.
A swindler's dream, Talon noted. What did they do for a living back in Varel?
They sold children to people whose tastes run in that direction,
Stegan replied in a disgusted tone.
As I understand it, Ogorodjin used to be one of their best customers.
That puts them right at the bottom, doesn't it?
Probably even lower than that.
Stegan glanced around to make sure they were alone.
Valish wants to meet you two.
Stegan pointed toward the end of the alley.
He's just up those stairs. He's renting a corner in the loft from a fellow who deals in stolen goods.
Talon smiled a rather nasty little smile. If these Dakites just happened to pass too much erroneous information and false rumors onto Krager, he might just decide that they've outlived their usefulness. Wouldn't you say?
Probably.
Stegan shrugged. That sort of stirs my creativity.
Oh? Why's that?
I don't like people who sell children. It's a personal sort of thing. Let's go meet this Valish. I'd like to find out if he's as gullible as you say. They climbed a rickety outside stairway to a door that was flimsy and patched, and showed some signs of having been kicked in a few times. The loft beyond the door was incredibly cluttered with all manner of worn clothing, battered furniture, and dented kitchen utensils. There were even broken farm tools gathering dust in the corners. Some people will steal anything, Talon sniffed. A lone candle guttered on the far side of the room, and a bony Aline sat drowsing at a table by its uncertain light. He wore a short green brocade jacket of a Daconian cut, and his sparse, mud-colored hair stood almost straight up, looking much like a thin, dirty halo around his gaunt head. As they crossed the loft toward him, he stirred himself and quickly picked up some papers and began to shuffle them in a self-important manner. He looked up with feigned impatience as they approached.
"You're late, Vimer,"
he accused in a high-pitched nasal voice.
"Sorry, Master Valish," Stegan apologized in a servile tone. "Fran and I were busy extricating young Reldon here from a tense situation. Reldon's very good, but he overextends himself sometimes. Anyway, you wanted to meet my associates."
He laid one hand on Sparhawk's shoulder.
"This is Fran. He's a tavern brawler. So we let him deal with any situation that can be settled with a few quick punches or a kick in the belly. The boy there is Weldon, the nimblest sneak thief I've ever known. He can wriggle through mouse holes, and his ears are sharp enough to hear ants crossing the street on the other side of town."
"I just want to hire him, Vimer," Valish said. "I don't want to buy him."
He giggled at his own joke. He smirked at them, clearly expecting them to join in his laughter. Talon, however, did not laugh. His eyes took on an icy glitter. Valish seemed a bit abashed by the reception of his feeble joke.
"Why are you all dressed as sailors?"
he asked, more for something to say than out of any real curiosity. Stegan shrugged.
"It's a port city, Master Valish. The streets are crawling with sailors. So three more won't attract any particular attention."
Valish grunted.
"Have you anything for me that I might find worth my while?"
he asked in a superior, bored tone of voice. Talon snatched off his cap.
"You'll have to decide that for yourself, Master Valish," he whined as he bowed awkwardly. "I did come across something, if you'd care to hear it."
"Go on," Valish told him.
"Well, sir, there's this rich Tommel merchant who owns a big house over in the fancy part of town. He's got a tapestry on the wall of his study that I've had my eye on for quite some time now. It's a very good one. Lots of tiny stitches, and the color hasn't faded very much. The only trouble is that it covers the whole wall. You can get a fortune for really good tapestry, but only if you can get it all out in one piece. It's not worth much if you have to cut it up to carry it out. Anyway, I went into his house the other night to try and come up with some way to get it out without butchering it. The merchant was in the study, though, and he had a friend with him, some noble from the imperial court at Mytherium.
I listened at the door, and the noble was telling the merchant about some of the rumors running around the Imperial Palace. Everybody's saying that the Emperor is very unhappy with these people from Eosia. That attempt to overthrow the government last fall really frightened him, and he'd like to come to some kind of agreement with his enemies. But this Sparhawk person won't let him. So Radian's convinced that they're going to lose. So he's secretly outfitted a fleet of ships all loaded down with treasure, and as soon as trouble shows up on the horizon, he's going to make a run for it. The courtiers all know about his plans, so they're secretly making arrangements for their own escapes when the fighting starts. Some morning, very soon, this Sparhawk's going to wake up and find an unfriendly army at his gates, and nobody around to hold them off. He paused. Was that the sort of information you wanted? The Dacite made some effort to conceal his excited interest. He put on a deprecating expression. It's nothing we haven't heard before. About all it does is help to confirm what we've already picked up. He tentatively pushed a couple of small silver coins across the table. I'll pass it on to Ponemdia and see what they think about it. Talon looked at the coins and then at Valish. Then he crammed his cap back on. I'll be leaving now, Vimer, he said in a flat tone. And don't waste my time on this cheapskate again.
Don't be in such a rush, Stragan said placatingly. Let me talk with him first.
You're making a mistake, Valish, Sparhawk told the Dacite. You've got a heavy purse hanging off your belt. If you try to cheat Reldan, he'll come back some night and slice open the bottom of it. He won't leave you enough to buy breakfast.
Valish put his hand protectively over his purse. Then he opened it with what appeared to be extreme reluctance.
I thought Lord Scarpa was at Matthios, Stragan said casually. Has he moved his operations to Ponemdia?
Valish was sweating as he counted out coins, his fingers lingering on each one as if he were parting with an old friend.
There are a lot of things you don't know about our operation, Vimer, he replied.
He gave Talon a pleading look as he tentatively pushed the money across the table. Talon made no move to accept the coins. Valish made a whimpering sound and added more coins.
That's a little better, Talon told him, scooping up the money. Then Scarpa's moved? Stragan asked.
Of course not, Valish retorted. You didn't think his whole army's at Matthios, did you?
That's what I'd heard. He has other strongholds as well, I take it?
Of course. Only a fool puts his entire force in one place, and Scarpa's far from being a fool, I'll tell the world. He's been recruiting men in the Aline kingdoms of Western Tomalee for years now, and he sends them all to Lydros, and then on to Ponemdia for training. After that, they go on to either Sinaclaw or Narenja. Only his crack troops are at Matthios. His army's at least 5 times larger than most people believe. These jungles positively seethe with his men.
Sparhawk carefully concealed a smile.
Valish obviously had a great need to appear important, and that need made him reveal things he shouldn't be talking about. I didn't know Scarpa's army was so big, Stragan admitted. It makes me feel better. It might be nice to be on the winning side for a change. It's about time, Sparhawk growled. I'm getting a little tired of being chased out of every town we visit before I've even had the time to unpack my sea bag.
He squinted at Valish.
As long as the subjects come up anyway, could we expect Scarpa's people out there in the brush to take us in if things turn sour and we make a run for it?
What could possibly go wrong?
Have you ever taken a good look at an Aton, Valish? They're as tall as trees, and they've got shoulders like bulls. They do unpleasant things to people, so I want a friendly place to come down if I suddenly have to take flight. Are there any other safe places out there in the woods?
Valish's expression grew wary, as if he had suddenly realized that he'd said too much already.
I think we know what we need to, Fran, Stragan interposed smoothly. There are safe places out there if we really need to find them. I'm sure there are many things Master Valish knows that he's not supposed to talk about.
Valish puffed himself up slightly, and his expression took on a knowing, secretive cast.
"You understand the situation perfectly, Vimer," he said. "It wouldn't be proper for me to reveal things Lord Scarpus told me in strictest confidence."
He pointedly picked up his papers again.
"We won't keep you from important matters, Master Valish," Fagin said, backing away. "We'll nose around town some more, and let you know if we find out anything else."
"I'd appreciate that, Vimer,"
Valish replied, shuffling his papers as his visitors departed.
"What an ass,"
Talon muttered, as the three of them carefully descended the rickety staircase to the alley again.
"Where did you learn so much about tapestry?"
Sparhawk asked him.
"I don't know anything about tapestry." "You were talking as if you did."
"I talk about a lot of things I don't know anything about. It fills in the gaps when you're trying to peddle something that's worthless."
I could tell by the way Valish's eyes glazed over when I mentioned the word tapestry that he didn't know any more about it than I did. He was too busy trying to make us think that he's important to pay any real attention. I could get rich from that one. I could sell him blue butter. Sparhawk gave him a puzzled look.
"It's a swindler's term," Fagin explained. "The meaning's a little obscure."
"I'm sure it is.
Did you want me to explain it?"
"Not particularly, no."
"Is it a family custom, or just a way to honor your father?" Barrett asked Kalad, as the two of them, wearing mail shirts and gray cloaks, lounged against the forward rail of the scruffy lake freighter plodding across the Sea of Arjun from Sopal to Tiana. Kalad shrugged.
"No, it's nothing like that. It's just that the men in our family all have heavy beards, except for Talon. If I decided not to wear a beard, I'd have to shave twice a day. I clip it close with scissors once a week and let it go at that. It saves time."
Barrett rubbed at his altered cheek. "I wonder what Sparhawk would do if I let his beard grow," he mused.
"He might not do anything, but Queen Aelana would probably peel you like an apple. She likes his face just the way it is. She's even fond of that crooked nose."
"It looks as if we've got weather up ahead." Barrett pointed toward the west. Kalad frowned.
"Where did that come from? The sky was clear just a minute ago. It's funny. I didn't smell it coming."
The cloud bank, hovering low on the western horizon, was purplish black, and it roiled ominously, swelling upward with surprising speed. There were flickers of lightning deep inside the cloud, and the sullen rumble of thunder came to them across the dark, choppy waters of the lake. "I hope these sailors know what they're doing," Barrett said. "That has the earmarks of a very nasty squall." They continued to watch the inky cloud as it boiled higher and higher, covering more and more of the western sky.
"That's not a natural storm, Barrett," Kalad said tensely. "It's building too fast."
Then there was a shocking crash of thunder, and the cloud blanched and shuddered as the lightning seethed within it. Both the young men saw the shadowy shape in the instant that the bluish lightning thrust back the darkness to reveal what lay hidden in the cloud. "Clell!" Barrett gasped, staring at the monstrous winged shape half concealed in the churning storm front. The next crash of thunder ripped the sky, and the shabby vessel shuddered in the overwhelming sound. The inverted wedge of Clell's face seemed to ripple and change in the midst of its veiling cloud, and the slitted eyes flamed in sudden rage. The great bat-like wings began to claw at the approaching storm, and the awful mouth opened to roar forth the thunder of Clell's frustration. He howled in vast fury, and his enormous arms stretched up into the murky air, reaching hungrily to clutch at something that was not there. And then the thing was gone, and the unnatural cloud tattered and streamed harmlessly off to the southeast to become no more than a dirty smudge on the horizon. The air, however, was filled with a sulphurous reek.
"You'd better pass the word to Afriel," Kalad said grimly. "Clow's loose again. He was looking for something, and he didn't find it. God knows where he'll look next."
"Tomie's arm is broken in three places," Sir Heldon rumbled when he joined the mail-shirted Patriarch Bergson, Ambassador Fontan, and Archimandrite Monsel in Monsel's book-littered study in the east wing of the palace. "And Darolin's still seeing two of everything.
Fomier can travel if he has to, but I think we'd better leave Daryl in here until he recovers.
How many knights are fit to ride? Bergston asked.
40,000 at most, Your Grace.
We'll just have to make do with what we've got. M. Van knew that we'd probably come this way. He's been sending messengers by the platoon. Things are coming to a head in southeastern Tamale. Sparhawk's wife has been taken hostage, and our enemies are offering to trade her for Bellium. There's a rebel army in the Arjunai jungles preparing to march on Mathirion, and two more armies massing on the eastern frontier of Seneska. If those armies all join up, the game's over. M'Ban wants us to ride east across the steppes until we're past the Estel Marshes, and then turn south and lay siege to the Seneskan capital. He needs a diversion of some kind to pull those armies back from the border.
Sir Haldin pulled out his map. It's workable, he said after a moment's study, but we're going to be a little light for that kind of job.
We'll get by. Vanyan's in the field, but he's badly outnumbered along that Seneskan frontier. If we don't create enough of a disturbance to relieve some of the pressure on him, he'll be swarmed under.
Haldin looked speculatively at the huge Silesian patriarch. You're not going to like this, Your Grace, he said, but there's not much choice in the matter.
Go ahead, Bergston told him.
You're going to have to lay your cassock aside and take command. Abriel's been killed. Darylin's incapacitated, and if Tomie gets into a fight, the weight of his axe will cripple him.
You're still here, Haldin. You can take charge.
Haldin shook his head. I'm not a preceptor, Your Grace, and everybody in the army knows it. I'm also a Pandian, and the other orders have strong feelings about us. We haven't made very many friends in the past couple of centuries. The other orders won't accept me as commander. You're a patriarch, and you speak for Sarathi and the Church. They'll accept you with no argument.
It's out of the question.
Then we'll have to sit here until Dolmont sends us a new commander.
We can't wait.
My point exactly. Do I have your permission to tell the knights that you're taking command?
I can't, Haldin. You know that I'm forbidden to use magic.
We can work our way around that, Your Grace. There are plenty of accomplished magicians in the ranks. Just tell us what you want done, and we'll see to it.
I've taken an oath.
You took another one earlier, Lord Bergston. You promised to defend the Church. That oath takes precedence in this situation.
The hugely bearded and black-robed Archimandrite Monsel looked speculatively at the reluctant Silesian. Then he spoke in a neutral sort of way.
Would you like an independent opinion, Bergston?
Bergston scowled at him.
You're going to get it anyway, the Estelian churchman said with unruffled calm. Given the nature of our opponents, we are face to face with a crisis of the faith, and that suspends all other rules. God needs your axe, Bergston, not your theology.
He squinted at the Silesian patriarch.
You don't seem convinced, he said.
I'm not trying to be offensive, Monsel, but crisis of the faith can't just be pulled out and dusted off whenever we want to bend some rules.
All right, let's try this one, then. This Astel and your church at Kyrellos recognizes my authority here. As long as we're in Astel, I speak for God.
Bergston pulled off his helmet and absently polished the glossy black ogre horns on his sleeve. Technically, I suppose, he conceded.
Technicalities are the very soul of doctrine, Your Grace.
Monsel's huge beard bristled with disputational fervor.
Do you agree that I speak for God here in Astel?
All right. For the sake of argument, yes.
I'm glad you agree. I'd hate to have to excommunicate you. Now then, I speak for God here, and God wants you to take command of the Church Knights. Go forth and smite God's enemies, my son, and may heaven strengthen your arm.
Bergston squinted out the window at the dirty-looking sky for a long moment, mulling the clearly specious argument over in his mind. You take full responsibility, Monsel? He asked.
I do.
That's good enough for me, then.
Bergston crammed his helmet back on his head.
Sir Haldin, go tell the knights that I'm assuming command of the four orders. Instruct them to make all the necessary preparations. We march first thing in the morning.
At once, General Bergston, Haldin replied, coming to attention.
Annika, Bellium's voice echoed in the vaults of Sparhawk's mind.
Thou must awaken. Even before he opened his eyes, Sparhawk could feel a light touch on the thong about his neck. He caught the little hand and opened his eyes.
What do you think you're doing? He demanded of the child goddess.
I have to have the bellium, Sparhawk.
Her voice was desperate, and her eyes were streaming tears.
What's going on, Aphriel? Calm down and tell me what's happened.
Sifrini has been stabbed. She's dying. Please, Sparhawk, give me the bellium.
He came to his feet all in one motion.
Where did this happen?
In Deirdre's. She was getting ready for bed, and Zelasta came into her room. He stabbed her in the heart, Sparhawk. Please, Father, give me the bellium. I've got to have it to save her.
She's still alive?
Yes, but I don't know for how long. Zanisha's with her. She's using a Delphaic spell to keep her breathing. But she's dying. My sister's dying.
She wailed and hurled herself into his arms, weeping uncontrollably.
Stop that, Aphriel. This isn't helping. When did this happen?
A couple of hours ago. Please, Sparhawk, only bellium can save her.
We can't, Aphriel. If we take bellium out of that box, Sirgon will know immediately that we're trying to trick him, and Scarpa will kill your mother.
The child goddess clung to him, sobbing uncontrollably.
I know, she wailed. What are we going to do, Father? We can't just let her die.
Can't you do something?
The knife touched her heart, Sparhawk. I can't reverse that. Only bellium has that kind of power.
Sparhawk's soul seemed to shrivel, and he smashed at the wall with his fist. He lifted his face.
What can I do? He hurled his voice upward. What in God's name can I do?
Compose thyself, Annika.
Bellium's voice was sharp in his mind.
Thou wilt serve neither Sifrinia nor thy mate by this unseemly display.
We have to do something, Blue Rose.
Thou art not at this moment fit to decide. Thou must therefore be ruled by me. Go at once, and do as the child goddess doth entreat thee.
Thou wilt condemn my wife.
That is not certain, Annika. Sifrinia, however, doth linger on the brink of death. That much is certain. It is her need that is most pressing.
No, I can't do that.
Thou wilt obey me, Annika. Thou art my creature, and therefore subject to my will. Go thou and do as I have commanded thee.
Chapter 12. Sparhawk dug into his sea bag, throwing clothes on the floor.
What are you doing? Aphriel demanded urgently. We have to hurry.
I've got to leave a note for Stragan, but I can't find any paper.
Here.
She held out her hand, and a sheet of parchment appeared in it.
Thank you.
He took the parchment and continued to rummage in the bag.
Get on with it, Sparhawk.
I need something to write with.
She muttered something in Syriac and handed him a quill and a small inkpot. Vimer, Sparhawk scribbled.
Something's come up, and I'll be gone for a while. Keep Raldan out of trouble.
And he signed it, Fran. Then he laid it in the center of Stragan's bed.
Now can we go?
She asked impatiently.
How are you going to do this?
He picked up his cloak.
We have to get out of town first. I don't want anybody to see us. What's the quickest way to the woods?
East. It's about a mile to the edge of the forest.
Let's go.
They left the room, hurrying down the stairs and out into the street. Sparhawk picked her up and half enfolded her in his cloak.
I can walk, she protested.
Not without attracting attention, you can't. You're a Styric, and people would notice that.
He started off down the street, carrying her in his arms.
Can't you go any faster?
Just let me handle this part of it, Aphriel. If I start running, people will think I've stolen you.
He looked around to make sure no one on the muddy street was close enough to hear. How are you going to manage this? He asked her.
There are people out there who can feel it when you tamper with things, you know. We don't want to attract attention.
She frowned.
I'm not sure. I was upset when I came here.
Are you trying to get your mother killed?
That's a hateful thing to say.
She pursed her little mouth in thought.
There's always a certain amount of noise, she mused.
I didn't quite follow that.
It's one of the disadvantages of having our two worlds overlap the way they do. The sounds of one spill over into the other. Most humans can't hear us or feel us when we move around, but we can definitely hear and feel each other.
Sparhawk crossed the street to avoid a noisy brawl that had just erupted from a sailor's tavern. If the others can hear you, how are you going to hide what you're doing?
You didn't let me finish, Sparhawk. We are not alone here. There are others all around us. My family, the Tamil gods, your Aline god, various spirits and ghosts, and the air is positively littered with the powerless ones. Sometimes they flock up like migrating birds.
He stopped and stepped back to let a rickety charcoal wagon creak past. Who are these powerless ones? He asked her. Are they dangerous?
Hardly. They don't even really exist anymore. They're nothing but memories, old myths and legends.
Are they real? Could I see them?
Not unless you believe in them. They were gods once, but their worshippers either died out or were converted to the worship of other gods. They wail and flutter around the edges of reality without substance or even thought. All they have is need.
She sighed.
We go out of fashion, Sparhawk, like last year's gowns or old shoes and hats. The powerless ones are discarded gods who shrink and shrink as the years go by, until they're finally nothing at all but a kind of anguished wailing.
She sighed again.
Anyway, she went on, there's all this noise in the background, and it sometimes makes it hard to concentrate or pick out specifics.
They passed another smelly tavern, loud with drunken song. Is this noise something like that? Sparhawk asked, jerking his head toward the singing. Meaningless sound that fills up your ears and keeps you from hearing what you're really listening for?
More or less. We have a couple of senses that you don't, though, so we know when others are around, for one thing, and we know when they're doing things. Tampering, if you want to call it that, for another. Maybe I can hide what I'm doing and all that other noise. How much farther do we have to go?
He turned a corner into a quiet street. We're coming to the edge of town now. He shifted her in his arms and continued on up the street, walking a little faster now. The houses here on the outskirts of Baressa were more substantial, and they were set back from the streets in aloof, self-important pride. After we go through the charcoal yards, we'll come to the woods, he told her. Are you sure this noise that I can't hear will be loud enough to hide your spells?
I'll see if I can get some help. I just thought of something. Sirgon doesn't know exactly where I am, and it'll take him a little while to identify me and pinpoint my exact location. I'll ask some of the others to come here and have a party or something. If they're loud enough, and if I move fast enough, he won't even know that I've been here.
There were only a few workmen tending the sullen fires in the charcoal yards that ringed Baressa. Incurious men, blackened by their tasks and far gone with drink, who lurched around the smoky flames like hellish imps dancing on eternal coals. Sparhawk walked even faster now, carrying the distraught child goddess toward the shadowy edge of the tangled forest.
I'll need to be able to see the sky, she told him. I don't want any tree limbs in my way.
She paused.
Are you afraid of heights?
She asked. Not particularly. Why?
Just asking. Don't get excited when we start. I won't let anything happen to you. You'll be perfectly safe as long as I'm holding your hand.
She paused again.
Oh, dear, she murmured. I just remembered something.
What? He pushed aside a branch and slipped past it into the darkness of the forest.
I have to be real when I do this.
What do you mean, real? You're real now, aren't you?
Not exactly. Don't ask questions, Sparhawk. Just find me a patch of open sky and don't bother me for a while. I have to appeal for some help, if I can find them.
He pushed through the tangled brush, a cold knot in his stomach, and his heart like a stone in his chest. The hideous dilemma they faced tore at him, seeming almost to rip him apart. Sophronia was dying, but he must endanger Aelana in order to save her life. It was only the force of Belium's will that kept him moving at all. His own will was paralyzed by the conflicting needs of the two he loved most in all the world. He pushed at the tangle surrounding him in a kind of hopeless frustration. Then he broke through the screen of brush into a small clearing carpeted by deep moss where a pool of water fed by a gurgling spring winked back at the stars, strewn like bright grain across the velvet night. It was a quiet place, almost enchanted, but his eyes refused to accept its beauty. He stopped and set Ephriel down. Her small face was devoid of expression, and her eyes were blank, unseeing. Sparhawk waited tensely.
"Well, finally," she said at last, in an exasperated tone of voice. "It's so hard to explain anything to them. They never stop babbling long enough to listen."
"Who's this we're talking about?"
"The Tamil gods. Now I can see why Oscania's an atheist. I finally persuaded them to come here to do their playing. That should help hide you and me from Sirgon."
"Playing?"
"They're children, Sparhawk. Babies who run and play and squeal and chase each other for months on end. Sirgon absolutely hates them, so he won't go anywhere near them. That should help. They'll be here in a few minutes, and then we'll be able to start. Turn your back, Father. I don't like having people watch me change."
"I've seen you before. Your reflection, anyway."
"That part doesn't bother me. The process of the changeover's a little degrading, though. Just turn your back, Father. You wouldn't understand."
He obediently turned and gazed up at the night sky. Several familiar constellations were either missing or in the wrong places.
"All right, Father. You can turn around now." Her voice was richer and more vibrant. He turned.
"Would you please put some clothes on?"
"Why?"
"Just do it, Ephriel. Humor my quirk."
"This is so tedious."
She reached out and took hold of a gauzy kind of veil she had spun out of nothing and wrapped herself in it.
"Better?"
she asked.
"Not much. Can we leave now?"
"I'll check."
Her eyes were distant for a moment.
"They're coming," she reported.
"They got sidetracked. It doesn't take much to distract them. Now listen very carefully. Try to stay calm when we do this. Just keep the fact firmly in mind that I'm not going to let you get hurt. You won't fall."
"Fall? Fall from where? What are you talking about?"
"You'll see. I'd do it differently, but we have to get to Dirgis in a hurry, and I don't want Sirgon to have time to locate me. We'll take it in easy stages at first, so you'll have time to get used to the idea."
She turned her head slightly.
"They're here," she said. "We can start now."
Sparhawk cocked his head slightly. He seemed to hear the distant sound of childish laughter, though it might have been only the sound of an errant breeze rustling the leaves in the treetops. "Give me your hand," she instructed. He reached out and took her by the hand. It seemed very warm and somehow comforting.
"Just look up at the sky, Sparhawk," the heartbreakingly beautiful young woman instructed.
He raised his face and saw the upper edge of the moon come creeping pale and luminous up above the treetops.
"You can look down now."
They were standing some 10 feet above the rippled waters of the pool. Sparhawk's muscles tensed.
"Don't do that," she said sharply. "Just relax. You'll slow us down if I have to drag you through the air like a waterlogged canoe."
He tried, but he didn't have much success. He was certain that his eyes were lying to him, though. He could feel solidity under his feet. He stamped on it, and it was as firm as earth ought to be.
"That's just for now," the goddess told him. "In a little while, you won't need it anymore. I always have to put something solid down for schizophrenia."
Her voice broke off with a strange little sob.
"Please get control of yourself, Sparhawk," she pleaded. "We must hurry. Look at the sky again. We're going a little higher."
He felt nothing at all. No rush of air, no sinking in the pit of his stomach. But when he looked down again, the clearing and its enchanted pool had shrunk into a dot. The tiny lights of Baressa twinkled from minuscule windows, and the moon had laid a long, glowing path out across the Tamil Sea.
"Are you all right?"
Her inflections were still Ephriel's, but her voice, and most definitely her appearance, were totally different. Her face peculiarly combined flute features with Danae's, making her the adult who had somehow been both little girls. Sparhawk didn't answer, but stood instead, stamping one foot on the solid nothing under him.
"I won't be able to keep that there when we start," she warned. "We'll be going too fast. Just hold on to my hand, but don't get excited and break my fingers."
Don't do anything to surprise me, then. Are you going to sprout wings?
What an absurd idea. I'm not a bird, Sparhawk. Wings would only get in my way. Just lean back and relax.
She looked intently at him.
You're really handling this well. Safrini is usually in hysterics at this point. Would you be more at ease if you sat down?
On what?
Never mind. Maybe we'd better stand. Take a couple of deep breaths, and let's get started.
He found that looking up helped. When he was looking at the stars and the newly risen moon, he could not see the awful emptiness under him. There was no sense of movement, no whistle of the wind in his ears, no flapping of his cloak. He stood holding Afriel's hand and looking intently at the moon as it receded ponderously southward. Then there was a pale luminosity coming up from beneath.
"Oh, bother," the goddess said.
"What's wrong?"
His voice was a little shrill. "Clouds."
He looked down and saw a fairy tale world under them. Tumbled white cloud, glowing in the moonlight, stretched out as if forever. Mountains of airy mist swelled up from a folded, insubstantial plain, and pillars and castles of curded cloud stood sentinel-like between. Sparhawk's mind filled with wonder as the soft, moonlit cloudscape flowed smoothly back below them. "Beautiful," he murmured.
"Maybe, but I can't see the ground."
"I think I prefer it that way."
"I need reference points, Sparhawk. I can't see where I am, so I can't tell where I'm going. Bellium can find a place with nothing but a name to work with, but I can't. I need landmarks, and I can't see them with all these clouds in the way."
"Why don't you use the stars?"
"What?"
"That's what sailors do when they're out at sea. The stars don't move, so the sailors pick out a certain star or constellation and steer toward it."
There was a long silence while the swiftly receding rush of cloud beneath them slowed and finally stopped. "Sometimes you're so clever that I can't stand you, Sparhawk," the goddess holding his hand said tartly.
"Do you mean you've never even thought of it?" he asked her incredulously.
"I don't fly at night very often." Her tone was defensive. "We're going down. I have to find a landmark."
They sank downward, the clouds rushing up to meet them, and then they were immersed in a dense, clinging mist. "They're made out of fog, aren't they?"
"Clouds, I mean."
Sparhawk was surprised. "What did you think they were?"
"I don't know. I've never thought of it before. It just seems strange for some reason."
They broke out of the underside of the cloud. Clouds no longer bathed in moon glow, now hanging close over their heads like a dirty ceiling that closed off the light. The earth beneath them was enveloped in almost total darkness. They drifted along, standing in air and veering this way and that, peering down and searching for something recognizable.
"Over there," Sparhawk pointed. "It must be a fair-sized town. There's quite a lot of light."
They moved in that direction, drawn toward the light like mindless insects. There was a sense of unreality as Sparhawk looked down. The town lying beneath them seemed tiny. It huddled like some child's toy on the edge of a large body of water. Sparhawk scratched at his cheek, trying to remember the details of his map.
"It's probably Sopal," he said. "That lake almost has to be the Sea of Arjun."
He stopped, his mind suddenly reeling.
"That's over 300 leagues from where we started, Afriel," he exclaimed. "Almost 1,000 miles.
"Yes. If that town really is Sopal."
"It has to be. The Sea of Arjun's the only large body of water on this part of the continent, and Sopal's on the east side of it. Arjun's on the south side, and Tiana's on the west."
He stared at her incredulously.
1,000 miles! And we only left Baressa 30 minutes ago.
Just how fast are we going?" "What difference does it make? We got here. That's all that matters."
The young woman holding his hand looked speculatively down at the miniature town on the lakeshore.
"Digis is off to the west a little way, so we won't want to go straight north."
She shifted them around in midair until they were facing in a slightly northwesterly direction.
"That should be fairly close. Don't move your head, Sparhawk. Keep looking in that direction. We'll go back up, and you pick out a star."
they rose swiftly through the clouds, and Sparhawk saw the familiar constellation of the Wolf lying above the misty horizon ahead. There, he pointed, the five stars clustered in the shape of a dog's head.
It doesn't look like any dog I've ever seen.
You have to use your imagination. How is it you've never thought of steering by the stars before? She shrugged.
Probably because I can see farther than you can. You see the sky as a surface, a kind of overturned bowl with the stars painted on it all at the same distance from you. That's why you can see that cluster of stars as a dog's head. I can't, because I can see the difference in distances. Keep an eye on your dog, Sparhawk. Let me know if you start to drift off course.
The moon-bathed cloud beneath them began to flow smoothly back again, and they flew on in silence for a while.
This isn't so bad, Sparhawk said. At least, not when you get used to it.
It's better than walking, the gauze-clad goddess replied.
It made my hair stand on end right at first, though.
Sifrini has never gotten past that stage. She starts gibbering in panic as soon as her feet come up off the ground.
Sparhawk remembered something.
Wait a minute, he objected. When we killed Gwerig and stole the Bellium, you came floating up out of that chasm in his cave, and she walked out across the air to meet you. She wasn't gibbering in panic then.
No, it was probably the bravest thing she's ever done. I was so proud of her that I almost burst.
Was she conscious at all? When you found her, I mean?
Off and on. She was able to tell us who attacked her. I managed to slow her heartbeat and take away the pain. She's very calm now.
Aphriel's voice quavered.
She expects to die, Sparhawk. She can feel the wound in her heart, and she knows what that means. She was giving Zanisha a last message for Vanyan when I left.
The young goddess choked back a sob.
Can we talk about something else?
Of course.
Sparhawk's eyes flickered away from the constellation in the night sky. There are mountains sticking up out of the clouds just ahead.
We're almost there, then. Deirdris is in the big basin lying beyond that first ridge.
Their rapid flight began to slow. They passed over the snowy peaks of the southernmost expanse of the mountains of Aton, peaks that rose out of the clouds like frozen islands, and found that there was only thin cloud cover over the basin lying beyond. They descended, drifting down like dandelion puffs toward the forest-covered hills and valleys of the basin, a landscape sharply etched in the moonlight that leached out all color. There was another cluster of lights some distance to the left, ruddy torches in narrow streets, and golden candlelight in little windows.
That's Deirdris, Aphriel said. We'll set down outside of town. I should probably change back before we go on in.
Either that or put on some more clothes.
That really bothers you, doesn't it, Sparhawk? Am I ugly or something?
No, quite the opposite, and that bothers me all the more. I can't think while you're standing around naked, Aphriel.
I'm not really a woman, Sparhawk. Not in the sense that seems to bother you so much, anyway. Can't you think of me as a mare or a doe?
No, I can't. Just do whatever you have to do, Aphriel. I don't really think we need to talk about how I think of you.
Are you blushing, Sparhawk?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I am. Now can we drop it?
That's really rather sweet, you know.
Will you stop?
They came down in a secluded little glen about a half mile from the outskirts of Deirdris, and Sparhawk turned his back while the child goddess once again assumed the more familiar form of the Styric waif they all knew as Flute.
Better?
She asked when he turned around.
Much.
He picked her up and started toward town, his long legs stretching out in a rapid stride. He concentrated on that. It seemed to help him avoid thinking. They went directly into town, made one turn off the main street, and came to a large two-story building.
This is it, Aphriel said. We'll just go in and up the stairs. I'll make the innkeeper look the other way.
Sparhawk pushed open the door, crossed the common room on the main floor, and went up the stairs. They found Zanisha all aglow and cradling Sophronia in her arms. The two women were on a narrow bed in a small room with roughly squared-off log walls. It was one of those snug, comfortable rooms such as one finds in mountain inns the world over. It had a porcelain stove, a couple of chairs, and a nightstand beside each bed. A pair of candles cast a golden light on the pair on the bed. The front of Zephrenia's robe was covered with blood, and her face was deathly pale, tinged slightly with that fatal gray. Sparhawk looked at her, and his mind suddenly filled with flames.
"I will cause hurt to Zalasta for this," he growled in Trollish.
Asriel gave him a startled look. Then she also spoke in the guttural language of the trolls.
"Your thought is good, Annika," she agreed fiercely. "Cause much hurt to him."
The rending sound of the trollish word for hurt seemed very satisfying to both of them.
"His heart still belongs to me, though," she added. "Has there been any change?"
she asked Zanisha, lapsing into Tamil.
"None, divine one," Zanisha replied in a voice near to exhaustion. "I am lending our dear sister of mine own strength to sustain her, but I am nearly spent. Soon both she and I will die."
"Nay, gentle Zanisha," Afriel said, "I will not lose you both. Fear not, however. Annika hath come with Delium to restore ye both."
"But that must not be," Zanisha protested. "To do so would put the life of Annika's queen in peril. Better that thy sister and I both perish than that."
"Don't be noble, Zanisha," Afriel told her tartly. "It makes my hair hurt. Talk to Delium, Sparhawk. Find out how we're supposed to do this."
"Blue Rose,"
Sparhawk said, touching his fingers to the bulge under his smock.
"I hear thee, Annika."
The voice in Sparhawk's mind was a whisper.
"We have come unto the place where Zephrenia lies stricken."
"Yes."
"What must we now do? I implore thee, Blue Rose, do not increase the peril of my mate."
"Thine admonition is unseemly, Annika. It doth bespeak a lack of trust. Let us proceed. Surrender thy will to me. It is through thy lips that I must speak with Anarae's Anisha."
A strange, detached lassitude came over Sparhawk, and he felt himself somehow separating, his awareness sliding away from his body.
"Attend to me, Zanisha."
It was Sparhawk's altered voice, but he had no consciousness of having spoken.
"Most closely, Worldmaker,"
Deanna replied in her exhausted voice.
"Let the child goddess assume the burden of supporting her sister. I have need of thy hand."
Afriel slipped onto the bed and took Zephrenia from Zanisha's arms and held her in a tender embrace.
"Take forth the box, Annika," Delium instructed, "and surrender it up unto Zanisha."
Sparhawk's movements were jerky as he pulled the golden box out from under his tunic and lifted the thong upon which it was suspended up over his head.
"Gather about thee that serenity which the curse of Edamus hath bestowed upon thee, Zanisha,"
Delium instructed the NRA in Sparhawk's voice, "and enfold the box, and mine essence in thy hands, letting thy peace infuse that which thou dost hold." Zanisha nodded, and extended her glowing hands to take the box from Sparhawk's grasp.
"Very good. Now take the child goddess in thine arms. Embrace her, and deliver me up unto her."
Zanisha clasped both Afriel and Zephrenia in her arms.
"Excellent. Thy mind is quick, Zanisha. This is even better. Afriel, open thou the box and draw me forth."
Delium paused.
"No tricks,"
it admonished her with uncharacteristic colloquialism.
"Seek not to ensnare me with thy wiles and thy soft touch."
"Don't be absurd, Worldmaker."
"I know thee, Afriel. And I know that thou art more dangerous than ever Azash was or Sirgon could be. Let us both concentrate all our attention upon the cure of thy sister."
The child goddess opened the lid of the box and lifted out the glowing sapphire rose. Sparhawk, all bemused, saw the steady white glow which emanated from Zanisha take on a faint bluish flush as Belium's radiance joined her own.
apply me poultice-like to her wound, that I may heal that injury which the Lasta hath inflicted.
Sparhawk was a soldier, and he knew a great deal about wounds. His stomach knotted when he saw the deep, seeping gash in the upper swell of Sophronia's left breast. Aphriel reached out with Belium and gently touched it to the bleeding wound. Sophronia started to glow with an azure radiance. She half raised her head.
"No,"
she said weakly, trying to push Aphriel's hand away. Sparhawk took both her hands in his and held them.
"It's all right, little mother," he lied softly. "Everything's been taken care of."
The wound in Sophronia's breast had closed, leaving an ugly purple scar. Then, even as they watched, the sapphire rose continued its work. The scar shrank down to a thin white line that became fainter and fainter, and finally disappeared entirely. Sophronia began to cough. It was a gurgling, liquid kind of cough, such as a nearly drowned man might make.
"Hand me that basin, Sparhawk," Aphriel instructed. "She has to clear the blood out of her lungs."
Sparhawk reached out and took the large, shallow basin from the nightstand and handed it to her.
"Here," she said. "You can have this back now."
She gave him the closed box, took the basin, and held it under Sophronia's chin.
"That's right,"
she said encouragingly to her sister, as the small woman began coughing up chunks of clotted blood.
"Get it all out."
Sparhawk looked away. The procedure was not pretty.
"Put thy mind at rest, Annika," Belium's voice told him softly. "Thine enemies are unaware of what hath come to pass."
The jewel paused.
"I have not given Edamus his due, for he is very shrewd. Methinks none other could have perceived the true import of what he hath done. To curse his children as he hath was the only true way to conceal them. I shudder to imagine the pain it must have caused him."
"I do not understand," Sparhawk confessed.
"A blessing rings and shimmers in the lucid air like bell sound, Annika, but a curse is dark and silent. Were the light which doth emanate from Enere's Anisha a blessing, all the world would hear and feel its o'erwhelming love. But Edamus hath made it a curse instead. Therein lay his wisdom. The accursed are cast out and hidden, and no one, man or god, can hear or feel their comings and goings up and down in the land. When she did take the box in her hands, Anere's Anisha did smother all sound and sense of my presence. And when she did embrace Aphriel and Sophronia, and enfold them in her luminous darkness, none living could detect me. Thy mate is safe, for now. Thine enemies have no knowledge of what hath come to pass."
Sparhawk's heart soared.
"I do sorely repent my lack of trust, Blue Rose," he apologized.
"Thou wert distraught, Annika. I do freely forgive thee."
"Sparhawk,"
Sophronia's voice was little more than a whisper.
"Yes, little mother?"
He went quickly to the side of the bed.
"You shouldn't have agreed to do this. You've put Aelana in terrible danger. I thought you were stronger."
"Everything's all right, Sophronia," he assured her. "Belium just explained it to me. Nobody heard or felt a thing while you were being healed."
"How is that possible?"
"It was Zanisha's presence, and her touch. Belium says she completely muffled what was going on. It has to do with the difference between a blessing and a curse, as I understand it. However, it works. What just happened didn't put Aelana in any danger. How are you feeling?"
"Like a half-drowned kitten, if you really want to know."
She smiled weakly. Then she sighed.
"I would never have believed that Zelasta could be capable of what he did."
"I'll make him wish he'd never thought of it," Sparhawk said grimly. "I'm going to tear out his heart, roast it on a spit, and then serve it up to Aphriel on a silver plate."
"Isn't he a nice boy?"
Aphriel said fondly.
"No."
Sophronia's voice was surprisingly firm.
"I appreciate the thought, dear ones, but I don't want either of you to do anything to Zelasta. I'm the one he stabbed, so I want to be the one who decides who gets him.
I suppose that's fair, Sparhawk conceded.
What have you got in mind, Sophronia?
Afriel asked.
Vanyan's going to be dreadfully upset when he hears about this. I don't want him raging and breaking up the furniture, so I'm going to give Zelasta to him, all tied up in a bright red ribbon.
I still get his heart, though, Afriel insisted.
Chapter 13. The sky was overcast with sullen cloud, and a chill, arid wind scoured the empty floor of the desert of Seneca as Vanyan led the retreat eastward. Fully half of his armored knights had perished in the encounter with Clell's soldiers, and very few of the survivors had escaped serious injury. Vanyan had ridden forth from Sarna with an army. He was returning at the head of a column of groaning invalids, battered and dented, after what had really been no more than a skirmish. 4 Aetons carried Engessa on a litter, and Queen Betuana strode along at his side, her face ravaged with grief. Vanyan sighed. Engessa was still breathing, but only barely. The preceptor straightened in his saddle, trying to shake off his shock and dismay, and to think rationally. The fight with Krell's warriors had decimated his force of church knights, and they had been central to the strategy of containment. Without those armored horsemen, the eastern frontier of Tommel proper was no longer secure. Vanyan muttered a sour oath. The only thing he could really do now was to warn the others about the change in the situation.
Sir Endrick, he called to the old veteran riding some distance behind, take over here. I've got something to take care of.
Endrick came forward.
Keep them going east, Vanyan instructed. I'll be back in a little bit.
He spurred his tired horse into a loping canter and rode on ahead. When he was about a mile ahead of the column, he reined in and cast the spell of summoning. Nothing happened. He cast it again, more urgently this time.
What?
Afriel's voice in his ear was irritably impatient.
I've got some bad news, Divine One, he told her.
What else can go wrong? Hurry up, Vanyan. I'm very busy right now.
We ran into Clell out in the desert. He had an army of giants, and we got mauled. Tell Sparhawk that I probably won't be able to hold Samar if the Seneskans lay siege to it. I've lost half the knights, and the ones I've got left aren't in any condition for a fight. Tikumi's Paloi are brave men, but they don't have any experience with sieges.
When did this happen?
About 4 hours ago. Can you find Abriel and the other preceptors? They should be in Zemok or Western Astel by now. They have to be warned about Clell. Tell them that under no circumstances should they engage in any pitched battles with Clell's troops. We're no match for them. If the main body of the church knights gets waylaid and wiped out, we'll lose this war.
Who are these giants you're talking about, Vanyan?
We didn't have time for introductions. They're bigger than the Aetons, though. Almost as big as trolls. They wear very close-fitting armor and steel face masks. Their weapons aren't like anything I've ever seen. And they've got yellow blood.
Yellow? That's impossible.
It's yellow all the same. You can come here and look at my sword blade if you'd like. I managed to kill a couple of them while I was covering Betuana's retreat.
Retreat? Betuana?
She was carrying Engessa.
What's wrong with Engessa?
He was out front a little ways, and Clell's soldiers attacked him. He fought well, but they swarmed him under. We charged into them, and Betuana cut her way through to Engessa. I ordered a retreat and covered Betuana while she carried Engessa to the rear. We are taking him back to Sarna, but I think it's a waste of effort. The side of his head's been bashed in, and I'm afraid we're going to lose him.
Don't say that, Vanyan. Don't ever say that. There's always hope.
Not much this time, Divine One. When somebody breaks into a man's brain, about all you can do for him is dig a grave.
I'm not going to lose him, Vanyan. How fast can you get him back to Sarna?
2 days, Afriel. It took us 2 days to get here, and 2 days out means 2 days back.
Can he hold on that long?
I doubt it.
She said a short, ugly word in Syriac. Where are you?
20 leagues south of Sarna, and about 5 leagues out into the desert.
Stay there. I'll come and find you.
Be a little careful when you approach Betwana. She's behaving very strangely.
Say what you mean, Vanyan. I don't have time for riddles.
I'm not sure what I mean, Afriel. Betwana's a soldier, and she knows that people sometimes get killed in battle. Her reaction to what's happened to Engessa is, well, excessive. She's broken down completely.
She's an Aton, Vanyan. They're a very emotional people. Go back and halt your column. I'll be there in a little while.
Vanyan nodded, although there was no one there to nod to, turned his horse, and rode back to rejoin his knights. Any change? He asked Queen Betwana.
She lifted her tear-streaked face.
He opened his eyes once, Vanyan Preceptor, she replied. I don't think he saw me, though.
She was holding Engessa's hand. I talked with Afriel, he advised her. She's coming here to have a look at him. Don't give up hope yet, Betwana. Afriel cured me, and I was closer to being dead than Engessa is.
He is fairly strong, she said. If the child goddess can heal his wound before it carries him off...
Her voice caught with an odd little note. He'll be all right, Your Majesty, he said, trying to sound more certain than he really was. Can you get word to your husband? About Clell, I mean? He should know about those soldiers Clell hides under his wings.
I'll send a runner. Should I tell Andril to come to Sarna instead of going to Tosa? Clell is here now, and Skopper's army won't reach Tosa for quite some time. And that's only if they can evade the trolls.
Let's wait until I've had the chance to talk with the others first. Is King Andril already on the march?
He should be. Andril always jumps when I suggest something. He's a good man, and very, very brave.
She said it almost as if defending her husband from some unspoken criticism. But Vanya noticed that she absently stroked Engessa's ashen face, even as she spoke. He must have been in a hurry, Stragan said, still puzzling over Sparhawk's terse note. He's never been very good at writing letters, Talon shrugged. Except for that one time when he spent days composing lies about what we were supposedly doing on the Isle of Tiga. Maybe that took it all out of him.
Stragan folded the notes and looked closely at it.
Parchment, he said. Where did he get his hands on parchment? Who knows? Maybe he'll tell us when he comes back. Let's go take a walk on the beach. I need some exercise. All right.
Stragan picked up his cloak, and he and the younger thief went downstairs and out into the street. The southern Tamil Sea was calm, and the moon path across its dark surface was unbroken and very bright.
Pretty,
Talon murmured when the two reached the damp sand at the edge of the water.
Yes,
Stragan agreed.
I think I've come up with something, Talon said. So have I,
Stragan replied.
Go ahead. No, let's hear yours first.
All right. The Seneskins are massing on the border, right?
Yes.
A good story could unmask them.
I don't think there is such a word.
Did we come here to discuss vocabulary? What will the Seneskins do if they hear that the church knights are coming? Wouldn't they almost have to send an army to meet them?
I think Sparhawk and Vanyan want to keep the fact that the knights are coming more or less a secret.
Stragan, how are you going to keep 100,000 men a secret?
End of Side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over.